Welcome to Arts Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Brian Katz, who is the artistic director and co-founder of Custom Made Theater in San Francisco. It's on Sutter off Powell. It's in a new theater, but it's been around 16 years. Currently, they're showing Of Serpents and Sea Spray by Rachel Bublitz, which is playing through January 30th. And also coming up is The Book of Liz by David and Amy Sedaris, directed by Brian Katz, which is at the Shelton Theater in the same building starting on January 20th. You've done that before.
This will be our sixth production of The Book of Liz. People keep wanting to see it, so we keep making it.
Well, let's talk a little about Custom Made, and then we'll get into last season's shows, some of the earlier shows, and the upcoming season for the rest of the 2015-2016 year. You co-founded this with Leah Abrams, and you both went to Clark?
Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, the Big Woo, as we call it.
And how did you get involved in theater?
My parents took me to theater since I can remember, which is how most of us got hooked originally. I was in Chicago. Musicals till I could handle The Goodman, which was at 13. And then they started taking me to the kind of theater that I generally like to do now. I got involved in high school. I was an actor. I was an actor for my sophomore year in college. I had no outlet for directing at that time. And it was the hobby that was consuming my life, but I wasn't really ready to admit that yet. I was a political science major for most of the time at Clark until I realized somewhere close to junior year when I was almost done with the major that I was spending all my time in the theater and I didn't want to be in the State Department anymore. So I kind of gave in. Like most of us who have done this for our lives, it's not a question of want. It's just a question of is, I guess, and it's what we have to do.
You were an intern at the Goodman?
At the Goodman, yeah. I was a dramaturg intern. They did not have a directing program. It was as close as I could get to the rehearsal room, although I didn't get that close that often because it's pre-Google, and I spent most of my time in the Harold Washington Library looking stuff up. It was a great experience, though. I got to see how a large Lord theater works. Directors I admire, Frank Galati and Bob Falls and Mary Zimmerman, who that's the one I did get to be in the room with on Journey to the West, and it was a great experience. I spent the year, it was a half year? I think it was a half year program, researching everything from the sheet music Three Sisters that Bob Falls is directing to prepping Rose Tattoo for him also. And then with Journey to the West, I actually got obsessed with all the, you know, it's five giant books of Chinese literature. And they're like, just read the first one. And I fell in love with it. I was like, wait, there's less scatological humor. And, of course, it's spiritual and lovely. And I got obsessed and read all five. And Mary Zimmerman found out that I was one of the few people in Chicago who had actually read all five books of Journey to the West. And I got invited to be more of an active assistant dramaturg, which generally still means just, you know, making sure the pages are in order and giving her some research. But because Mary does her own thing.
And what brought you and Leah Abrams to the Bay Area?
We actually started Custom Made in Boston. Our first show was actually at Clark during the summer. They let us use the theater. We did a Lee Blessing play, and about 20 people came, but it was good. And then we worked at the Boston Center for the Arts, which is still around, for a couple of shows. I had been in Massachusetts for 6 years off and on at that point, and Leah was from there. I think we were just mostly looking for a change and maybe a little larger theater community. Boston at the time was pretty small. People went to New York right away, it seemed like. I had a friend out here in Berkeley who had designed my sets in college, and we visited and went, oh, my gosh, it's beautiful, and it's warm, and there's a pretty good art scene, and we're still in our 20s, so we decided to pick up our lives and move.
And the first show you did was in 1998-99 season. There was only one play.
Orchards, I think. Oh, geez. Was that the studio of Theater Rhino? All our time being nomadic, right, when we went theater to theater, is a litany of theaters that do not exist anymore, sadly, in the Bay Area. Venue 9, Theater Rhinoceros, when they used to have the 16th and South Van Ness space, we worked there a lot. We worked at New Langton Arts. I don't think they rent anymore to theaters. Oh, Orchards, I remember this now, was at a place called Bannon Place in North Beach, which I'm pretty sure doesn't exist anymore. It was us and some rats that were in that theater.
What prompted you to have your own theater company?
When I first started trying to be a freelance director, I guess, in my early 20s, I was doing some festival theater in Chicago, trying to get anybody to let me either AD or direct a play, God forbid, which is a shock after college, after you're, you know, you're able to program whatever you want. And I was brought back out to Worcester to direct a musical at Clark. Leah's 2 years younger, so she was just graduating at the time. I basically said, hey, listen, we're not really forming a company yet, but we think we have some talent. You know, let's produce a show. Let's see how it goes. I was always a little more eager to form a company in the beginning than she was. Eventually, you know, the response was good enough that we were able to keep going. It certainly comes from a desire to see what I want to see on stage. I think all artistic directors have to have that to some extent. To be brutally honest, I wanted to work. I wanted to do the plays I wanted to do, and I didn't want the career path where you go around the country trying to direct someone's production of Almost Maine. Let's say the one that's popular right now, right? And that is a life you can have if you want. I probably always thought I was going to do grad school at some point, and this will be a temporary thing, and Custom Aid just kept being successful. It was never thought out like this is our 20-year project. It was kind of step-by-step for a while. And then, again, to produce the kind of work we wanted to see, I wanted to see at that time especially more political work than I was seeing around town. Not all of our titles are, but I always leaned towards Brecht and Havel and playwrights like that, and we wanted an outlet for that kind of work.
And how did you promote it in those early days before? I mean, it's pretty hard to start up a theater company in the Bay Area, particularly when you have established companies like The Magic, like ACT, which actually around the time that you started was around the time that Carrie Perloff came to ACT mm-hmm. and turned it around, but there was also Berkeley Rep. There have been a lot of established companies. Were you just kind of like winging it?
A little bit. We certainly have had mentors along the way who've helped us know what to do in producing small theater. There's many things about it that are easier now because of the internet, for sure, and easier to get word out, which is what that's about, right? Small arts marketing. But we had people who early on were able to handhold us a little bit. A friend in New York who was doing PR for off-Broadway companies. Like, this is how your press packets have to be. This is how when you mail them out. This is how you get a list of them. Theater Bay Area has always been a good support organization in terms of at least here's the labels. That's what we used to do, by the way. Whereas we don't do that anymore. There was the labels for all the press agents. And right. So you'd put your packets in the mail. What amazes me when I think about it now is how expensive everything was. We had to mail all these things. We had to take our Nikon cameras and shoot black and white reels and go to Walgreens and have them developed and pray that, you know, two or three shots came out. And then you had to, you know, blow them up and you had to do large photos for the press. And all this was generally going into a packet that was never going to get put into a newspaper. Some of it was just throwing money away. None of that you have to do anymore. It's still, of course, incredibly difficult for all companies. When we started off, we did 9 shows. We didn't cast a show that had less than 5 people if we could help it, generally because they're going to bring their friends. Some of this was done during the first dot-com boom, too, right? So
right. There's
a lot of 20-somethings in the city, a little different situation, who were supporting the arts a little more, or at least they were my friends because I also worked with them at my day jobs, and they would come and they liked us. You know, and it kind of went from there. But so it was, of course, incredibly difficult, and only 20-somethings can do it that level because you don't need sleep at that point, or at least you can not sleep for 4 days and then catch up, right? Things we can't do anymore. We'd rent a place like New Langton, which is one of our favorite places to rent. They'd give us a space for the full week and leave us alone, and we'd come in on Saturday or Sunday and start painting and building, and the set would be up the day before the audience shows up, right? And my poor TD hasn't slept in 3 days and is going to his day job. Yeah, these are things we cannot even imagine doing anymore.
Brian Katz, as I was looking at the scheduling and the history of Custom Made Theater, I noticed that in 2004 it expanded and then expanded again. When did you wind up with the place on Gough Street?
Well, Gough Street was the second theater we managed, actually. I believe when the show started expanding beyond 3 a year is when we took over part of off-market theaters. That was between 5th and 6th on Mission. And our friend Matthew Quinn, who has run Theater Asylum down in L.A. now and helps the Fringe Festival down there, had a couple spaces we had rented once or twice for him, and he ended up letting us manage our own. Really, it was a room. It was an office building converted into a theater. We used to have a joke that we could not cast an actor over 6'2" because they'd hit his head on the lights. We did a couple years there, and they were somewhat successful, but the rent kept going up like crazy. And eventually both theaters ended up being priced out. Piano Fight started there, too. They were across the hall from us, which was always pretty funny. We were doing Beckett, you know, and then across this paper-thin hallway, those guys are doing a rambunctious comedy. It was an interesting place to work for a while. Lewis Campbell, who runs multi-ethnic theater, doing the August Wilson cycle right now, had acted for me in an Albee show called Finding the Sun, and we became friends, and he was running what was called the Next Stage then with Marcia Kimball. He basically saw what was happening with us financially and said, listen, I'm in my 70s. I don't need to run a full season anymore. Do you have an interest in taking over that space? It saved my company, to be honest, because we were in such a financial situation with Off Market that moving in there, less expensive rent, and also a place that we could call a little more our own. And we landed up at Gough Street for five, six years, I believe.
What brought you to the theater on Sutter? That used to be the San Francisco Playhouse Theater before they moved across the street.
SF Playhouse, and then Tides took over for a couple years in between. Tides had been there. Jenna Welsh is the artistic director. This is such like a small theater story and lovely in how random it is. Jenna was producing, I believe, a Playwrights Foundation reading that I was directing. One of our actresses got sick. So Jenna takes over the role, does a lovely job. I love directing Jenna. We become friends. And we had decided that we were going to create a happy hour or something for artistic directors because we all needed a place to drink on Friday nights and get this out of our system. The next time I see her, I'm like, hey, how about that happy hour? And she turns to me and starts talking about the fact that she needs someone to take over at least part of the season. At Sutter Street, she has another program called Storyworks, which is taking her all over the country, and so she couldn't manage the space anymore. So eventually we get talking, and within about a month and a half, we've signed the lease on the place. It happened very, very quick. We had not planned our season for Sutter Street, which is challenging for a couple shows this year because we had a thrust theater with an extension in mind, and now we're in a very thin proscenium. But it's been wonderful, and we were looking, if not right away, in the near future, to try to move closer to BART. We had had a good East Bay audience coming in when we were off market, and Gough Street was difficult for them. And by the way, Gough Street is surviving. Lewis Campbell has taken it back over. They're doing a full season, and I really hope everyone supports them because they do really important work. It's very community-based, and they're continuing to do the August Wilson cycle. So if you haven't seen one
What's the name of that company?
Multi-Ethnic Theater.
Brian Katz, custom-made is now at Sutter, and that means that you actually have to have real sets.
The thrust theater we were in took more money than you expect to construct because it was very tall. There's some sound issues there. Hurwit, when he first came, Rob, described it as very live, and that is an apt way of putting it. We would tell actors, especially because we had it in a thrust, if you turn your back to the center section, you have to pretend you're playing to a 300-seat house, even though it's a 60-seat house. It was actually built as a chapel. And so music sounds beautiful in there because everything just kind of rises, the ceiling reverberates. It's not so great when you're trying to do a stage whisper. I kind of love thrust as a director in my own way. It certainly allows you a lot of creativity. It can be maddening also because everyone sees a different picture. And you're trying to paint pretty ones. You're like, well, what about the people sitting in the back over there? You're like, oh, gosh. Some shows were easier than others, like a good four-person show. Everybody's moving. It's not a problem. Something for, like, The Crucible, which we had done, and it's a very, very large show. The director, Stuart Bosso, had to be extremely careful with moving everybody around just so everybody could see anything in terms of the larger stories.
Let's talk a little about what Custom Made has been doing lately. Now, last season, you did manage to get the musical Grey Gardens. Had that been produced in the Bay Area before?
I believe Theater Works did a production. But it had not been done in the city, which is always attractive to us, to bring it to our audience. And I don't think it had been done in the East Bay either. So I think we had a lot of people come from both of those locations.
And this season, one of the best productions I've seen this year was your production of This Is Our Youth. How did you manage to get that one? It had just been successful in a Broadway revival.
Yeah, we never know. I'm in season planning right now, so I'm going through it, where you put out the request and you cross your fingers and you hope, and sometimes they just say instantly yes, and you're like, great, I'm not going to ask any questions.
When I talk to Bill English, he kind of goes, the pecking order, you know, you have to get past the big ones, then you're kind of fighting with Marin, and but that's still a level above you guys.
Oh, yeah, no, if Playhouse wants something, I'm not going to get it, and that's okay, I get it, and they've earned it. It used to be easier. We are a much bigger community than when I started out here, and the example I give a lot is Red Light Winter, Adam Rapp's play, which had been done at Steppenwolf. It goes off Broadway. I apply for rights and somehow get it. And I was shocked, but it used to happen once in a while. I'm pretty sure now there's no way I would have gotten that play, and that's been one of my favorites. We look for plays that haven't been done in the Bay Area. Sometimes we look at what play hasn't been done from that playwright who's rising, who we really love.
Is that something like Middletown next season?
Well, yeah, Middletown. Will Eno has a production history in the Bay Area, of course. Right. Cutting Ball had done a Tom Paine based on nothing, and Berkeley Rep did Tragedy of Tragedy. I actually had tried for rights for Middletown for a couple of years. And I suspect, I never know because nobody ever tells me these things, you know, the Realistic Joneses comes out, it's a big hit, ACT is going to do it, and Middletown kind of got passed over. I love Middletown, and I am ecstatic that no one else has gotten it. We are excited about these plays from these incredible playwrights.
You're listening to an interview with Brian Katz, who is the artistic director of Custom Made Theater. You could find out more about Custom Made by going to their website, custommade.org. World premiere of Serpents and Sea Spray, now playing through January 30th. Also, starting January 20th, is The Book of Liz by David and Amy Sedaris. I'm Richard Walensky on Arts Waves. Let's talk a little about Of Serpents and Sea Spray. This is a world premiere. Does that mean you, that Custom Made, commissioned it?
We did, actually. And it's the first time we've ever done that. We've done world premieres before that have been brought to us, just plays that never got a production. But Rachel Bublitz, who is the author, had approached us. I knew Rachel through some circles and said that she had this idea of a play. I don't remember how much had been written yet, but it certainly wasn't full script, that had been proposed to the Olympians Festival, which happens every year. It wasn't accepted for Olympians. Nothing tragic here. She had another idea accepted that year. This one just wasn't. And she was still excited about it. So she approached us and said, would you be interested in commissioning this? We worked out a nice situation where we would help develop it. We would give it some readings. If we kept getting excited about it, we'd eventually look at a production. Playwrights hear that a lot, by the way. And sometimes along the way, you know, the production doesn't happen for whatever reason. Every time we got the script or had a reading, we just got more excited about the show and the way it was developing. So we're so proud of it because it's our first really from egg to production kind of project.
What are the themes of the show?
It's about a 12-year-old girl played by an adult actress. She is an orphan. You know pretty early in the play she has a tragic backstory, not knowing necessarily what it is. In her mind, to escape this terrible situation she's in with foster parents, she goes on a quest to rescue Pegasus. She's commanded by Athena to do it. Then there's a couple of other adventures along the way, almost exclusively in the first act. And the second act becomes something completely different, which I don't really want to spoil. But there is another member of her family that's out there that she reunites with through these stories. It is Coraline-like. And for those more of my age group, a little Time Bandits-y in its humor. It is definitely about finding you're not alone. It is about how a child's imagination can cope with tragedy and then the process of dealing with it and knowing that you have to deal with it to move on in life. But it's a lovely, inventive, and delightful tale. Ariel Kraft is an extremely inventive director, and I think audiences are going to find it very delightful and very emotional, too.
Have you gotten over the fact that the theater was robbed?
Yeah, we were robbed. We found out about it opening night of a production. So someone had taken our lighting equipment. It was a bunch of computers that we had hatched together, basically, right, for Love of Warcraft. We have no idea who, and we've just moved on. We fundraised, and we have a patchwork of computers running things right now, and we're fundraising so we can get a better lighting situation anyways. Like, once we recover completely, we will have improved our space. And I think that's what you have to do in that situation. It's like, all right, this is an opportunity. We've got to spend some money anyways. Let's be better than we were.
Creating a set for a fantasy, do you go low-tech or do you try to go high-tech?
Well, in this case, it's pretty low-tech, actually. Ariel's vision, along with Rachel's script, really calls for a mostly handmade approach to the story, because it is out of her mind. And there's some beautiful scenic work, which is coming in, a lot of drapery, a lot of cloth and stuff like that. There is going to be some projections, so there's a little technology involved, but it's not a projection-heavy show.
The next show you have is something called Sam and Dee Dee, or My Dinner with Andre the Giant. Mm-hmm. Now, I learned about the relationship between Samuel Beckett and Andre the Giant from Cary Elwes when he was talking about The Princess Bride. When Andre the Giant was a kid, he got a ride to school from Samuel Beckett, and I assume that's what this play is.
That's the origin of Gino DiOrio is a New York-based playwright who Lee and I happen to know because he was our professor at Clark. He was an acting professor before he became an incredible playwright. Samuel Beckett owed Andre the Giant's father some money. In return, Andre had a disease. This wasn't just a large man. This was a man who was so oversized, and it made his life tragically short as well. Couldn't fit in the school bus, so Sam Beckett gave him a ride to school. And Gino asked the question probably everyone's thinking, what did they talk about?
Soccer.
Cricket, too. They both love cricket quite a bit. But then it goes beyond. There's a couple scenes in the truck, but then Gino imagines a relationship for the rest of their lives. Who knows if they ever saw each other again, right? But it really does ask that question. You have a writer who's obsessed with silence, and you have a guy who literally can't hide. And then, well, what do they talk about? It's a fascinating play. It's one we've loved for quite some time. Yeah, we're really excited to introduce this to everyone. It's certainly had some unique casting challenges. It's a small play in other ways for a man about a big guy. I'm sure the theater people like know Sam Beckett, right? And Andre the Giant has this Princess Bride crossover. But it's also about wrestling, and I'm just fascinated by this stuff. They talk about that, too. It's just a really unique show that I think you'll just never see anything else quite like this one.
Middletown by Will Eno is kind of a takeoff on Our Town?
Mm-hmm. It's his inn, I'd say. There is a public speaker that begins the play that is sort of like the stage manager. But then there's a cop later on who's also kind of like the stage manager. Eno's an absurdist. Although you can say that Our Town, in its own way, is a bit of an early absurdist play. There's no props. There's the final scene, which is just so tragic and beautiful. It's a mediation on life and why we're here, which Our Town is also. So I think it has that in common with it. And after that, Eno kind of goes his own direction. There's little hints at it, but it's certainly not like the absurdist update of Our Town. Those who love Our Town will certainly find things that they love in it.
Is it like Our Town in that you don't need a set?
Sadly, we do need a set. That would have made life easy. We need to see, like, inside houses at different times and outside houses. It's the show in the season that's the most challenging to move. Like, we knew how to do it at Gough Street, and now we've had to rethink what we're planning to do with it. You know, as I said, we were trying for the rights for a couple of years. We weren't going to give it up.
That brings up a question. Were all of the shows that you selected for this year originally going to be Gough Street then?
That is correct. And sometimes that worked out great. Like, This Is Our Youth was like, oh, a unit apartment set at Sutter Street? Okay. Well, that worked out well. I wasn't worried about Thrust at that play, but I did the play despite it being in Thrust, not because it was in Thrust.
Right.
I thought it would be fun to be in their bedroom, but honestly, I kind of wanted to be looking in a window. That was our whole idea of that set, was like, you should feel like you're just, you know, there's a little glass wall between you and that apartment, and that's
right,
it.
Yeah.
You know, no breaking the fourth wall on that one. And then other shows would have benefited from Thrust. But, they were all programmed. We cast anywhere from 8 months to 14 months ahead of time these days. So, you know, we had to have a season. And we certainly, when it all happened, we had to look at each show and go, all right, can we still do it? And we decided that, yeah, we'd find the magic. We'd find a way to make it work. People had already bought subscriptions and all that.
And the final show of the season is 6 Degrees of Separation by John Quare, mm-hmm. which has been around.
Yes.
It seems that in each season, I mean, last season had 3 tall women. It sounds like in each season you're sort of looking for one kind of semi-canonical play. Is that
right? one or two, depending on the season. This season's probably a little unique that it only had one. There's a bunch of reasons for that. I mean, I certainly love presenting great American modern classics, and we're always going to have our own take on it and do something interesting with them. I mean, there's a movie, obviously, of Will Smith, but it's a very Brechtian play, and the film doesn't capture that at all. So even people who have just seen the film, I think they're going to be surprised. It's not that how different the play is, but how different it feels.
What is your take that makes it so different, you think?
I'm hoping he's still planning this. Stuart Bissell is the director, and he is planning to have everyone on stage the whole time. So there's going to be almost a community watching the story unfold, and that's the jumping-off point. So then we'll see what else comes out of that. But that was the initial idea when he presented it to me of something he wanted to do with the play, was to really, you know, it's a story about interconnectivity, right? It popularized the 6 degrees theory that all of us are only 6 people away from each other. Just going to small intimate theater for people who only have gone to ACT or Berkeley Rep or been taken there by a partner, whatever it is, you know, you get a completely different experience in small theater when you can actually, you almost feel like you reach out and touch the actors. But also just how emotionally stronger that connection can be, I believe. So that's one of the reasons for doing them. And when we did The Crucible, it was the same kind of thing. It's like, yeah, everybody knows what happens. There's also something to be said for the plays that kind of have been too many people have seen a bad high school production of. And there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, you should do bad high school productions. It's okay, you're kids. But also it can give a play a reputation that it doesn't maybe deserve. And, like, doing The Crucible, one of the reasons to do it was, like, by the way, this is a really important play that still needs to be seen and still needs to be investigated.
Do you get equity actors at all?
On occasion. When we did How the World Began last season, that was Mary McGoyne, who's an equity actress, who had worked with us before she was equity. So we were able to invite her back. There's a play coming in August that's announced, but the cast is not, which is Steve Yockey's The Thrust and the Woodpecker, which is a rolling world premiere through National New Play Network. We just got approved for a guest contract, so that will have a pretty well-known equity actress in it that we're very, very excited about. The contract situation is complicated in the Bay Area, especially for a small theater. I don't want to get too much into the politics of it. I sort of feel like there's a missing middle ground somewhere that theaters like mine should be able to take advantage of that we can't. We're not at a point where we can afford a contractor show, which I think is where we'd love to start off, or maybe for a year. You know, that's something that we're talking to the equity office about and seeing if there's something that can be worked out. San Francisco is slightly unique in that our non-equity pool is kind of amazing. A lot of them never go equity. Sorry, yes, the Actors Union, because there's not enough work for them, because there's not enough middle theaters, I guess we'd say the mid-sized theater, that can employ them. It's a problem in the community that we don't have a solution to right now, and companies like mine, which wish to grow, have a little difficulty breaking into doing more contracts for union actors. Many of our actors, though, I would put up next to anybody and say that these are just as incredible, and they've just decided to do a different way in their lives. I'm fully in support of unions and actors' equity. It's also our stage managers' union, by the way, too. So add in stage manager into the mix. The economics of art is very, very difficult and tight, and nobody has enough money. So it's always a difficult situation.
Brian Katz, what do you think distinguishes Custom Made at this point?
I think at this point we have a reputation for having generally among the best actors in the non-union community doing very, hopefully, interesting work that generally are plays that you, and again, there's some exceptions, the 6 degrees of separation, that you will not see elsewhere, but it's a very eclectic season with a lot of different styles and tastes. So what you're getting, basically, is sort of what the larger LORT theaters do, the big regional theaters, but you're getting it in a small theater environment with professional production values, and you're getting that intimacy of the small theater experience done at a high level.
And the political end of it. You started more as a political theater. What's happened to that?
Kind of a combination of things. Certainly my own growing up a little bit. And I'm slightly more interested in exploration of why we're here now than I am in raising my fist at the system. And we were never fully agitprop, although we did some of that. I still love Brecht and then Kushner more than just about anything. But there's also a reality of producing that no one's going to come see a full season of Brecht. We might do a play here and there. We have a lot of balancing that we're doing and a lot of diversity we're worrying about and new plays, old plays, and classics. In the end of all, it's what we like to see, and the theater's programming has changed. Leah is, well, she's the executive director, is also very involved in season planning and the direction of the company. And it's the questions as we've gotten older that we're asking that we want to see answers to.
Brian Katz, one thing that is concern me is, well, this diversity, of course, which means getting not only diversity on stage, but getting diversity into the theater. The other problem is getting younger people interested in theater. The last time I was over at Custom Made, I talked with someone who worked there named Max, and he's 23, mm-hmm. and he started naming his favorite theaters, and I'd not heard of one of them. Is there this underground younger theater that the rest of us just simply don't know about? And if there is, where does Custom Made fit in there?
We all started off that way, right? We were all the younger, the ones who have survived. We were all, Crowded Fire was the younger theater once upon a time. In fact, started like the same year we did. Cutting Ball was too. The venue I mentioned before, which is Piano Fight, which is a place that they can afford to rent and also know that an audience will come. The Exit Theater, of course. I'm a big fan of Faultline, which Max is one of their producers. He's also my resident lighting designer. Also Breadbox, which is a small company that people should be paying attention to, that does a couple shows a year. They're a resident company at the Exit. There's always companies that start off and can make a splash, and then, 5 years is a bit of a cliff for everybody for some reason. I don't know. I was told that year 1, year 3, year 5, year 10 were all cliffs. And that data, someone has data that shows that those are ones you have to get past. You either grow at that point or you go do something else.
Do you pay attention to something that I know Marin does a lot of this, is one play talking to another? Is that something that concerns you at all?
Not too much. I do think the seasons are a curated event. So I guess I'd have to ask what exactly they meant by that. I do think as a whole, they kind of feel like something. We don't name them. I think we did that once. We might have named a season. And then I was like, oh, that's ridiculous. I don't want to do that again. I got tired of talking about it, like 2 weeks
in. Also, if you could get the show that you really want.
That is always part of it. And also, like, directors bring me shows, too. Some of the shows are brought to me by certain directors who are very excited about them. And I read it and I go, oh, I love your work and I love this play. Let's do this. And I'm not really going to wonder too much about how it fit with Slaughterhouse-Five. On the other hand, I think I'm worried more about the opposite. I kind of worry about, like, do we have plays that feel repetitious? Do we have two classics next to each other? Do we want to have a new play there? So if for our subscribers who are experiencing the full season, they've had a good ride. You know, it's got a bit of an arc to itself. Our new plays have generally been in this, like, January, February slot, something we've done 2 years in a row and we may do again next year. It allows us to produce plays that are a little riskier and give them shorter runs. We're also doing, and I didn't mention this, with Salmon, Day-Day, and Serpents, we're calling it the Undiscovered Work Series. It's not something we're, like, blasting on postcards, but it's kind of an internal and a grant writing thing. But it's going to get expanded. And we're going to try to keep this time of year probably for plays that we really know we're taking big risk on. We share designers for it. It's one unique thing we're doing, is that the same, even though these two plays have different casts and different directors, they're sharing the scenic designer, lighting designer, sound designer, and costume designer. And the set has to turn over in about 4 days. So it's being designed to basically flip like it's a repertory theater, right? It's been fun. It helps us save resources. It's a fun project for the designers, hopefully. They might listen to this and go, no, not at all. But it's been a way that we've been able to program some even riskier stuff than we have in the past.
From what I can see, the two best shows I've seen over at Custom Made were Grey Gardens and beyond that, This Is Our Youth. Would you kind of agree with that?
Some of these are my children, so it's hard to pick them, right? Isn't that such a cliche answer? Grey Gardens was wonderful. As an artistic director, it was such an easy process because I came in for, like, the first time I saw a run, and it was wonderful. And I was like, okay, well, it's, you know, there's always stuff to work on, but it was right. Like, well, this, you're like, well, this works. This works better than I thought when I read the script, and that's always a lovely moment. This Is Our Youth, I directed, so it's really hard to get me get distance from that, but I can say the process with those three actors was wonderful and seamless, and always, we were always working towards a goal, and it felt like we were always getting closer every day. I direct very differently with, like, a three-person play. And when I say a three-person play, it's a two-person play because there's only 90 seconds in the play where, like, three characters are actually on stage talking to each other in just sort of a little bit in the second act. The plays like that, I don't really like to pre-block at all. I mean, I kind of have an idea where we're going, but I'm like, I got two actors, and the play just, like, kind of composed itself, and I don't even know when it happened, and it was lovely. It was a wonderful experience.
It also feels as if there's something about the play that will allow any given actor in the play to bring in their own world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's because it's 320-somethings, so you're casting 320-somethings. Once you cast them, they're the characters. And there are very few plays that really, really work like that. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Katie is actually 19 when she started the play. So she's actually the exact age of the character, which right. You don't get too often when you're casting that kind of character. I knew Katie. She was in Top Girls for us, and we already loved her. But it was an early decision, and I've told a lot of actors who, like, auditioned for this play who I didn't use, who I love. Listen, I went with the 20-year-old cast. I went with the young ones because when a 28 next to the 19 was kind of creepy, actually.
So how old were the two?
I think David, who played Dennis, I'm 22 or 23, and Sam, who played Warren, maybe 25, 26, but he's obviously very young-looking. But that's still very young. They taught me. I taught them how to, like, handle a phone in the 80s, how to use the record player, and that was an adventure. Why you'd wait for the extra ring, and there was a time before call waiting, by the way. Yes, you could actually lie and say I couldn't get through to you because your phone was off the hook. So I taught them that kind of stuff, but they were the ones who were the even more than – the director's always a bit of an emotional BS detector, right? Like, that feels real. That doesn't feel real. They knew. And Katie had a wonderful thing to say to me, which was at some point in the process, she's like, this play takes place in 1982, right? And by the way, this is not exactly my era either. I'm like 8 years older than this, but – felt pretty similar. She's like, if you put cell phones in here and you talked about Facebook or whatever, she's like, it's the exact same things my friends talk about. Like, that's how on track Lonergan is on that script. It is timeless for what it is to have those weird little years, either before college or right when you're out, or if you don't go, you know, where you don't know what's next, what to go, what the plan is, and everything is overwhelming and everything is over emotional. And it's a beautiful script. And of course, that's the start of it, right? Which is that this beautiful script teaches us as well.
Brian Katz, now you're in the new place, and now I guess it's just consolidating what you have and working from there. So this is a new project for you.
Yeah. I don't feel like we've had to rebuild audience. We've had to teach them that we're not where we used to be because some of them go to the old space and come to us in a panic. But generally, we have more seats now, and 99 feels a lot bigger than 60. We're in growth mode. We're trying to figure out the marketing. That's a lot of it. And, you know, we're a small theater, so we all wear a lot of hats. And my other hat is marketing, even though it's not the thing I am best at in the world. And trying to figure out how to tell people we're here. The best way to tell people you're there is do great shows, right? And have people go away and go tell people they saw in this little weird, it's next to the 7-Eleven. You know, you go upstairs, the long flight of stairs, and then you're going to see a very different experience than you expect in a small theater environment. Season planning is always season planning, and so we're in the midst of it right now. But now we're thinking about the space, and now we're thinking about the audience that we're getting in the space and a combination of what they want to see and what we want them to see.
And you want to make sure the audience is young and grows with you, which is another thing.
That's the difficult part. The Love and Warcraft show we just did, in Love and Warcraft, which was another show about – we did two shows about 20-somethings in a row, which – they had to be at that time, unfortunately. And we've had younger people in the house than I'd say we've ever had because of the nature of those two shows. Now, we'll find out. Although Rachel is a young playwright, and Ariel's a young director, so – and Serpents is – it's not for children. I think anything 12 and older is probably fine, but it's an adult show. So we always try to do work that's going to be accessible to all ages. But, yeah, all theaters are trying to keep younger people in because they hopefully grow up with you. We have subscribers who are in their 30s and 20s, and they are so valuable to me. Just not that my other subscribers aren't, but what if they're with us for 20 years, right? What if their kids then join? We've had subscribers meet and start dating at our place. We're hoping that's the future, right? We'll just get them that way. And you know, hopefully work that's fresh always feels young.
You've been listening to an interview with Brian Katz, who is the artistic director of Custom Made Theater, which is located on Sutter off Powell Street. You can go to custommade.org to find out more information. Of Serpents and Sea Spray is now playing through January 30th, and Book of Liz begins on January 20th in the same building. I'm Richard Walensky on Arts Waves.